a real privilege to be here and be able to share and talk with a group of parents like this. I think over the years, 15 years of youth ministry and family ministry I've been involved in, I've developed a real love and deep respect for parents of teens. One of the hardest jobs, I think, in the church, and especially one of the hardest times in our lives developmentally. I often say there's two teachable moments in the life of a parent. One is the first few weeks and as we bring the baby home from the hospital, and the other is the first few months of our first bout with adolescent rebellion or acting out. Very teachable moments in the life of a parent. So we're glad that you're here and you can be a part of this. And I don't want to give you the impression at all as we begin that there's going to be some cookbook, no-fail approaches shared here. That if you guarantee to, or if you do these 12 steps, that you're guaranteed to have instant success. Parenting is a hard thing. And it's much more like an art than it is a science. Much more of an art than a science. And that's why it's so hard to, for us to say, well, do it like them. If everybody does it like this couple over here, then the results are guaranteed. In fact, Scripture is very clear. I think the writers of Scripture go a long way to stay away from cookbook approaches and try to give us general principles in which thinking parents in the context of those general principles can begin to apply those and help their kids through what's a very difficult time in their lives. We'll be talking more about that as we go along. But let's begin by directing our attention to Proverbs chapter 19 and 20. And look there at the fact that it really is possible. It really is possible to understand how our teens, how our children look at their world. You might look at their behavior and think, how in the world am I going to make sense of this? There cannot be any logical reason for them acting this way. But there really is, almost underneath any behavior that you observe in your teenager, there's some logical explanation for it. They have a logic for it. It's possible to understand how they're looking at their world and responding to it. And we learn a little bit about men and women and even teenagers here from Proverbs chapter 19. Now observe with me verse 21. And in this verse we notice the fact that there are two things that are common about both man and God. We read here in verse 20, many are their plans in a man's heart, but it's the Lord's purposes that prevails. Both man and God have purposes. They're purposeful. And I think that has a lot to do when the scriptures say that man is created in God's image. That's a big part of it. The man and God are both purposeful. Underneath what they do, they have purposes that govern them or control them. And that's certainly true about our teenagers. But the verse goes on and says there is one big difference between God and us, and that is that God's plans are never frustrated, but ours often are. Oftentimes, the things that we would like to see happen, the things that we're desperately out to get, the things that we're looking to fill our lives with, oftentimes those are frustrated and blocked. But God's never are. It says what a man desires in verse 22, what he really longs for, what he's really moving toward, where his purposes are aimed at, so to speak. What a man desires is unfailing love for himself. Unfailing love for himself. A big part of the answer about where are our kids heading, what are they doing, is wrapped up in this verse. What a kid deeply longs for is a relationship of unfailing love, a certain kind of relationship that he's looking for. Now, part of the confusion that kids are going through, and adults go through this too, is based on the dilemma that we see over in chapter 20, verse 6 of Proverbs. Just hop over with your finger right there, chapter 20, verse 6. It says, many a man claims to provide this kind of relationship of unfailing love. Many a man claims to have unfailing love. Many people will make a promise to you that, yeah, I'll be there for you, I'll come through. If you just pick up this marijuana cigarette and take some drags with us, you'll find unfailing love. You'll find the kind of relationships you're really looking for. Many a person will claim to give those to our kids. But look at the dilemma in verse 6. But a faithful man, somebody that's really going to come through on that promise, who can find? Imagine, our kids are still at a naive stage in life, still young enough to think that they're going to find somewhere a relationship that's really going to provide the unfailing love that they long for in the deepest parts of their of their lives, deepest parts of their hearts. Now, jumping back to chapter 19, verse 23, we see where the real answer is to that. Where a man's purposes can really be fulfilled, it says in verse 23 of chapter 19, the fear of the Lord leads to life. Then one rests content, untouched by trouble. What our kids long for is unfailing love, and that relationship is offered by a lot of people. There's a lot of deception that the kids think that they can find that in a lot of different places. But the fact is, only in a relationship, a personal relationship with the Lord, can they find what they really long for that's going to rest their souls, that's going to bring them to contentment, a place where they can go through the troubles and trials of life and have a stronghold. Now, in verse 5 of chapter 20, let's go over to chapter 20 now and stay there. We discover an interesting truth here. It says in chapter 20, verse 5, that the purposes of a man's hearts are deep waters, but a man of understanding is able to draw them out. The purposes of a man's heart are deep waters. It means that they're often very subtle, what our kids are heading at and toward. It's often kind of hidden. They're deep. And it's much here like we're talking about a well or something that's 10 or 12 or 14 feet underwater. And you can just get a glimpse, maybe as you're standing above it and looking down to the bottom, you can just get a glimpse of what might be at the bottom. But it's often subtle and kind of distorted, and the light refracts as it goes through the water. And you got a hunch about what's going on inside your kids' lives, but you're not real, real sure. And this verse gives us the assurance that it really is possible, as we seek to become men and women of understanding, it really is possible to begin to understand our kids on much deeper levels. It really is possible to begin to draw out, like we drop a bucket down to the bottom and take a sample of what's down there and then pull it up. It really is possible to start sampling and getting an idea and coming within a certain degree of certainty what is going on in our kids' hearts. And that prepares us to know how to respond to them. That prepares us to know how to parent them if we've got an idea of what we're dealing with. What's the first thing a doctor does when someone comes in complaining of an illness? Well, he wants to find out what he's dealing with before he makes any prescription. Before he prescribes any kind of treatment, he wants to know what he's dealing with. And it's just as important for a parent to have some idea of what he's dealing with in terms of heart purposes of his kid before he begins to prescribe treatment or discipline or correction or response or encouragement, whatever it might require. It takes some understanding. And if we had to sum it up in simple terms, we can say this is a course for parents in helping them become men and women of understanding, of knowing how to sample what's deeply embedded in the hearts of their kids. What are the governing purposes of their lives? How are they trying to get that deep need for unfailing love met? What are the silly ideas? How are they trying to pull it out of people who are unfaithful? How are they trying to get it out of them? And our kids come up with a number of silly ideas about how they're going to make their life love them, how they're going to make their world love them. Now, we have some encouragement here as we go on, though, in verse 11. You say, well, how in the world do you understand what's going on deep inside of my kid? I mean, at supper time, we sit and I ask him, hey, how'd the school go today? And he goes, okay. And I say, oh, well, how in the world am I supposed to understand what's going on? Verse 11 gives us some encouragement. It says, even a child is known by his actions, by whether his conduct is pure and right. Parents oftentimes don't get a lot of verbal cues from their kids about what's going on. Now, there are a lot of hidden messages underneath our kids' words. But there's an even more hidden message underneath their actions, the directions they're moving, the goals that they're pursuing behind their behaviors. And a good parent has to be a good student of their students, has to be a good student of their children, and in watching and observing their behavior. And as you get good at analyzing your child's behavior, watching the directions he's moving, watching the goals he's pursuing, some things begin to dawn for us. We start thinking, that must be what my kid thinks is the foundation to life. That must be what he thinks where he's going to find life. Man, he is just controlled or obsessed with the idea of getting the kids at school to like him. I mean, I watch his behavior and watch how many hours he spends in front of the mirror and watch how many hours he spends getting himself ready for school and watch how many hours he spends trying to make sure that he's not going to hurt or offend any of his friends. That must be, since all his behaviors aim that way, that must be one of the hidden purposes of the heart. He must really believe that if he could just get people to like him, if he can just capture a group of those peers to accept him, that must be what he believes will give him life. Huh. So as we watch our children and study their behaviors, we begin to get a good clue into what's deeper in their hearts. Now, sometimes they give us verbal cues. They do reveal that. But oftentimes we don't get that, and we have to be good detectives. Just very good at sitting down and studying behavior and putting it together. And we'll spend time in this course talking about how you do that. How do you analyze your children's behavior? We have one lecture coming up just entitled Making Sense of Your Children's Behavior. And we'll give some ideas of how you would trace that back to their heart purposes. Now, in verse 24, we see that, again, this isn't very easy coming back down to understanding what our kids' heart purposes are. It says in verse 24 that a man's steps are directed by the Lord. How then can anyone understand his own way? Boy, our kids need help. There's no way in the world that they're going to be able to sit down and figure out what's going on in their own lives. They need help. It's just an amazing relief to a lot of kids when they come in for different problems, and I see them in the counseling office, and toward the end of the session, the first session, I will say something like this. You know, coming to a counselor, it almost makes you feel like you're crazy, doesn't it? You ever afraid of the fact that maybe you're going crazy or there's something wrong with you, the way you think? Let me assure you, you're not going crazy. There's some things that are happening, and they're very understandable. They're very logical, and I want to help you take a look at that and understand that. And it just takes a big boulder, big ton off the kid's shoulders to understand that there's some rhyme or reason to this. There's some reason why I'm starving myself. There's some reason why I'm just scared to death to be around girls. There's some reason for the fact that I just can't talk to my mom. There's some reason for the fact that they're just terrified or depressed about a particular incident. There's reasons for it. There's some logic behind it. And it comes back to the purposes in their own heart that are being blocked or frustrated or they're scared they're never going to achieve them. Verse 27 tells us what one of our main weapons are, one of our main tools in this ministry, this deep ministry to our kids' hearts. It says, the lamp of the Lord searches the spirit of a man, and it searches out his inmost being. The lamp of the Lord, metaphor, normally referring to the Bible, the Scriptures, being the lamp of the Lord. And we're going to have to sit down with an open Bible and with our kids' lives and wrestle with both. And in many, many ways, we're going to bring this to bear in being able to help our kids and understand themselves from the Scriptures. It's going to be one of our main tools. Now, in the last verse in this chapter, we've got both good news and bad news for parents. Good news and bad news for kids. Verse 30. Says, blows and wounds cleanse away evil, and beatings purge the inmost being. Now, not only are there deep purposes that are ruling our kids' lives, and not only is it possible to know what those deep purposes are, but it really is possible to shape them. It really is possible to cleanse them. It really is possible to get to them and touch them. It says that blows and wounds can cleanse away evil, and beatings can purge the inmost being. That's the good news. It really is possible to get into those inner heart beliefs and governing assumptions of our kids and shape them and work on them. It really is possible. But the bad news is this. It's going to be painful. It's going to cause conflict. It's going to involve oftentimes being unpopular with our kids. It's going to be oftentimes involve doing things that they'll scream foul about. Now, I believe the words here, blows and wounds and that kind of thing, are symbolic, and it doesn't mean just spanking and paddling and those kinds of things. We'll get into some discipline and correction things. But the blows and wounds it's talking about here involve any kind of response on the part of a parent that goes toward cleansing that child's governing beliefs, what's deep in his heart, the purposes of governing. So it's really possible to understand it, and it's possible to also alter them and change them. And we can say this is a course in deeply understanding our kids, and as we come to understand what their heart purposes are, building the kind of environment that increases the probability that those heart purposes, by the time they leave for college, are going to resemble what God wants them to resemble. So course in that. Not just in shaping our children's behavior, because that's going to come along if we can get to their heart. The behavior will come along as we get to their heart. We'll study the behavior, but to get to the heart, because that's what the Lord wants. Paul says in 1 Timothy, he says, you know what the goal of our instruction is? The goal of our letters, the goal of our ministry? It's love from a pure heart, from a sincere conscience. The goal is love from a pure heart. And that's the goal of our parenting that we're looking at. Now let's move from here and look a little bit at what the world of an adolescent looks like and understand a little bit of perhaps how our adolescent looks at life. Now we'll be following right along in your notes here and going right with number two here. We want to talk about the fact that the world of an adolescent is changing. It's changing, and oftentimes adolescence is referred to as a period of disappointment. It's referred to as a period of change. Because oftentimes, see, what happens is kids find ways to kind of make their life work pretty well as children. As kids, by the time they're in third, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, they're kind of down to practicing some strategies for interacting with mom and dad, for their friends at school, for their teachers, with their world. They've got some strategies that are working pretty well for them. And life is kind of stable. Now, there's some exceptions, but generally speaking, life during that time for kids is kind of stable because they kind of learn now what their world expects of them and how to deliver in a way to get this kind of love they're looking for, this relationship. But now some significant things begin to happen as puberty arrives, as the child begins to develop primary and secondary sexual characteristics, as their bodies begin to change, as their minds begin to change, the world begins to look differently at them and begins to expect some new things from them that they never expected before. And let's talk about that first, changes in what his world expects from him. And in three categories we want to talk about. First of all, the world begins to expect something different in terms of reasoning abilities. In terms of reasoning abilities. In 1 Corinthians 13, Paul says, when I was a child, I reasoned as a child. But when I became a man, what did he do? Put away childish things. Aren't you anxious for that to happen in your home? But the question is, when does a kid become a man? When does he become mature? And when can we begin to expect the childish reasoning to disappear? When can we begin to expect that? And the question is, are our expectations close to when it really happens? Do the time at which we expect kids to start thinking more like adults, is it the time when they're really capable of doing it? There's a chart I want to point out to you right up here in the overhead. And we're calling this chart Changes in an Adolescent's World. And you notice across the top we have ages 2 through 26, or 0 through 26. And the article you have that was passed out this morning, The Invention of Adolescence, documents a lot of what I'm going to be sharing with you right now. You don't have to look at the article, but let me just share some details about this. Now, we want to talk about historically what has been kind of the scheme at which kids have merged from childhood into adulthood. And adolescence is kind of that hazy period of adjustment or transition. And we notice here that the physical status of a child historically, up until the last 50 to 100 years, a child has pretty much stayed a child physically until somewhere between ages 16 and 18. Now, that might be a little hard to believe, but our medical records that go back in the mid-1800s show that, for example, an adolescent girl didn't have her first menstrual cycle until somewhere around age 17 and a half. Today, she has anywhere from 12 and a half to 13 and a half, her first menstrual cycle. And the same thing is happening with guys. They begin development of their mature sexual characteristics at a much earlier age than they did even 100 years ago. And some sociologists say that it's moving back 3 months for every decade. So others say, well, it stopped in the 60s and it's not going to move back any farther. We don't want any kids being born adolescents. Come on, let's give us some time to adjust. But the explanation that's often been offered here is just nutrition and just better ways of raising kids and healthier. And what happens is that kids' bodies get bigger, and their bodies are built the way that if they get to a certain size, they automatically trigger the processes of puberty, and they begin to develop primary and secondary sexual characteristics. And so as their bodies are getting bigger because of nutrition, it triggers all these things earlier. And so we've got kids at one time staying like children until 16, 17, but today we've got them starting 4 or 5, 6 years earlier. Some kids begin at age 10 and a half. Others are late bloomers, but somewhere around 12 and a half to 13 and a half is the average. Now, some other things are interesting here, too, as we look at this chart. Over the years, as our society has become industrialized and technology has made it more and more complex to live in our world, it's taken longer and longer for children to get ready to fill adult roles in society, especially to be able to support their families economically. And so we see what used to be the fact that children, even before they became adults physically, were already starting to be accepted and given adult roles in their society. They're already given full-time jobs. Many of them, even before puberty had been complete, were married. And you'll notice in the article I passed out that there's a lot of documentation there about the age at which kids over the centuries have been married. And most of them get married just as soon or just before puberty hits. But today, what do we have? Well, we have a situation that children are becoming mature physically at an all-time early age, and yet because they're being born into such complex industrialized societies that it's taken them all-time long period of time to get ready for it. So we have a period of time where kids have approximately 10 years between the time they're able to enter into mature sexual relationships and the time that there's any legitimate outlet for those desires and drives. There's never been a generation of mankind before the last 50 years that have had to face that before. Your kids are one of the first generations ever in the history of mankind have had to face a 10-year period of time in which they were mature enough physically to enter into a marriage relationship, but not mature enough emotionally or prepared to face the pressures that our society puts on a married couple. And so we've got that. Now, here's another factor that even makes it a little bit more interesting, and that's this, that the intellectual status. Now, it's very clear from research, and most scholars will agree, that adults think differently than children. Children think in something that's called concrete operations, and adults think in what's called formal operations. And formal operations enable an adult to think abstractly, think about possibilities, to think about ideas, to think about others on a deeper way. There's all kinds of new capacities that come with adult thinking capabilities. And over the years, research has been done to try to see when can kids begin thinking like adults. And the age at which they're capable has stayed about the same, but the age at which they're choosing to exercise adult thinking capacities is moving back right now. Kids are eligible as soon as they start entering puberty. Their bodies start to change, their minds start to change too, and they're capable of thinking on a lot deeper levels. They're capable of reasoning through principles and in abstract terms. But we're finding from research that kids are choosing to use those adult thinking capacities at a much later age. Where years in the past, kids would begin to use these ages 13, 14, 15, and begin thinking a whole lot like adults. Research is showing because the way schools have been organized differently and curriculum has been changed, the fact that kids are being exposed to things like television that do not exercise abstract thinking capabilities. Kids don't read very much anymore. Even kids don't even listen to music without watching videos. All of these things means that kids can put their minds in neutral and don't have to do the picturing and the practice of abstract thinking. And as a result, kids aren't really starting to use their abstract thinking capacities until a much later age, maybe 16, 17, 18, some into their early 20s. So here we had a situation where we had a kind of a safety net here before. Before a kid even had a full mature adult body, he already was pretty much thinking like an adult and he already had pretty much some adult roles to fulfill some of those needs. But now we have a situation where there is not a safety net, where children become like adults in their bodies in a much earlier age, and yet they have several years before they start thinking like adults and they start filling the roles of an adult in our society. That's dangerous. It's dangerous for anyone to have an adult body and a child's mind. And that's why we're having such a great difficulty with sexual promiscuity among teenagers today. And this is something that our kids are facing in this lifetime that an awful lot of parents over the centuries of mankind have never had to face before, and you're having to face it now as parents. How in the world do I help my kids through this 10-year period of time in which there's pressures put on them that they're not really not ready yet to handle. So there's changes and a whole lot in what the world expects of them in reasoning abilities. The world tends to expect them to think like an adult if they look like an adult. If you dress like an adult, you have hair like an adult, you do adult things, you process adult information, you watch adult television shows, you go to adult places, then you ought to think like an adult, right? And so kids are really expected to be able to reason and think on a much more mature level than most of them are capable of doing or most of them have had practice doing. So the world changes all of a sudden, and when a kid starts to look like an adult, he's expected to start thinking and reasoning like one. And the problem is, he's just not, most kids just aren't ready till their late teens. Now, a second place in which the world has changed for the kids is what they expect in roles from relationships. That's point B in your outline, or the second point there under A. In roles and relationships. Now, in order to generalize, people tend to take one of two roles in relationships. They tend to be either fuelers or drainers. And children, with a few exceptions, normally are very draining people, right? And that's okay because their role, even scripturally, is not to be fuelers. They're not to be fueling their parents. They're not to be the basis for providing that need parents have for unconditional love. They're to be drainers, and until they get old enough to be able to go directly to the Lord themselves and get their needs for relationship met, they're to get those met through the parents, so it's okay for kids to be drainers. And parents are to be fuelers. And the problem is that once kids start moving toward adolescence, and they begin to have adult mature bodies, and they begin to be bigger structurally, there's a whole lot of expectations now that are placed on them to be fuelers in the family now instead of drainers. They enter boyfriend-girlfriend relationships, and now a person of the opposite sex who's used to getting his needs met by his mom or dad now looks to your daughter to be his fueler. And now she has new pressure put on her because now she's a fueler all of a sudden for an adolescent boy who maybe comes from not a too good a home situation. He's not getting fueled at all by his parents. And now he's looking to get it all from your daughter. Or your daughter is looking to get it all from a teenage guy. All of a sudden, the world kind of expects our kids, as they begin to mature physically, to be fuelers for them, to start giving back. And oftentimes, our kids, even though they ought to be moving toward those roles, they're just not ready to do it to the degree that we expect. We have a 10-year-old daughter, and she's getting to be 10, we're expecting that she's going to need to be helping around home more. You know, we kind of expect her to be helping to babysit with the other two girls and expect to be helping now a little bit with the dishes. And her role is starting to change in the home now. She's starting to move from just being a drainer to a fueler. But that can be hurried to such a degree that she's under so much stress that it makes it almost difficult for her to be able to accomplish all the other things she needs to accomplish during this period of adolescence. So the key is for parents to grade this transition from being a drainer to a fueler. But imagine how your world changes all of a sudden and now expects you to start paying it, expects you to start coming through for it. That's an adjustment. And the third area where expectations change is in response ability, the ability to respond to situations. It's interesting in David Elkin's book, All Grown Up and No Place to Go, Teenagers in Crisis, which is a book that one of the books we're going to recommend you might want to do some reading out of during the next 12 weeks this series goes on. He mentions the fact that in his early practice, when he started as a psychologist, that he was seeing a lot of kids in the 60s that would be labeled spoiled kids. He says in the late 70s, early 80s, the kids he started seeing in his office started changing. And they were no longer the spoiled kids of the 60s that he started seeing. They were the hurried children of the 70s and 80s, children that were being hurried to grow up too fast. And that's the reason for his title, All Grown Up and Nowhere to Go, kids who are rushed into thinking and acting, at least thinking that they are adults and acting like adults and wearing clothes like adults and taking on some roles as adults, and yet they're really not ready to be there to face the stress that adults face and their ability to respond to situations. In one section in this book, he talks about innocence markers, how they're disappearing, how kids are not allowed to be innocent like they used to be able to up until a certain age, that we're rushing them with adult information. And he quotes a person, Neil Postman, in his book, The Disappearance of Childhood. And he says, Postman argues that childhood is or was a period of innocence when children were protected and shielded from certain kinds of information. But in the past two decades, however, the protection for children have vanished, and today's children are exposed to all sorts of information. Since contemporary society no longer holds the idea of childhood as a period of innocence, does that mean children have disappeared too? And further, is there no place in the society now for teenagers? Have they disappeared as well? And he goes on and says, it's certainly true what Postman contends, that society no longer seems to regard children as innocent or to see childhood innocence as positive. And it's also true that every young child is today exposed to every nuance of human vice and depravity under the mistaken assumption that this will somehow inure them to evil and prepare them to live successful, if not virtuous and honorable lives. This assumption rests on the mistaken belief that bad experiences prepares someone for bad experiences. In fact, just the reverse is true. A good experience is the best preparation for a bad experience. Innocence markers provides good experiences, in their absence too often bad ones. And he's arguing for the fact that the kind of responsibilities, and a lot of responsibility comes with adult information that we give our kids, that it needs to be looked at, and we need to be careful about that. But the world is changing in what it expects from the kids in thinking, what it expects in them in relationships, and what it expects in them as far as the amount of responsibility that they can do. And in a lot of ways, they're hurried children. He mentioned, David Elkin mentions that there's books out now to tell mothers who are expectant how within the first 3 to 8 months to do certain things which will guarantee that their child will get a college scholarship and get on the gymnastics team when they're in high school. But they have to start at 3 months. So in many ways, kids are hurried. And imagine if that's how toddlers are hurried, imagine how teenagers are hurried. Now, there's also, though, another change in our kid's world, and that's a change in what he notices about his world and himself. This changes at this time because the kid's thinking capacities do start to change. As soon as their bodies begin to explode, and every organ and every bone and every muscle in their body is affected except the brain during this period of time, everyone grows. Stomach for a guy grows 90% in about 3 years. 25 to 50% for a girl. The sleeping needs multiply the amount of sleep that they need. And facial features change. The nose changes anywhere from 25 to 75%. And your facial features, what used to be cute, little, distinct, sensitive features, now become larger adult features that sometimes are hard for a child to handle. His body's exploding and everything's changing, and his mind starts to change too. And with the thinking becomes some new abilities. Let me mention a few here that are in your outline. First of all, he begins to notice how things might have been in a much deeper way. Now, children have a way of doing this too, but not as spontaneously, not as automatically as teenagers now. Now, your child, for the first time as he moves into adolescence, can begin to wonder what it would have been like and picture what it would have been like if dad hadn't left when he was 2 or 3. Of what it would be like if mom and dad had a good marriage. Of what it would be like if dad had a different job and we had the same money that some of my friends at school had. If I didn't go to Christian school, or if we didn't go to a Christian church, or if we didn't have a Christian home with all those silly rules, I understand what it might have been like. And with that is a new capacity to be angry and ashamed with his world. A new capacity to be angry because now you can picture what it might have been like if someone hadn't messed it up for you back then. What it would have been like if you hadn't been molested as a little child. What it might have been like if you hadn't had that disease that weakened one of your bones and took you out of football. There becomes a new ability now to feel bitter and angry and ashamed about yourself toward your world. Now, secondly, there's a new ability to observe how things should be different. How things should be different. Now adolescents are able to evaluate the status of how things are and compare them against ideals. And notice that, hey, wait a minute. Our home, our church, our school, our circle of friends aren't what they're supposed to be. Things should be different, and with that becomes a whole new capacity to be disillusioned and critical. Have you noticed that? A whole new capacity to be disillusioned and critical with his world. And that's a natural stage the child goes through as he begins to discover that, hey, you know, this isn't how it was supposed to be. I was told by Mom and Dad that if you're a Christian, that basically that was the best way, and you'd be rewarded by being honest and not cheating. But I look around in school, and I see the kids that cheat are the ones that tend to get ahead. The kids that go out and party are the ones that tend to have the best time. Now, wait a minute. I've got to go back to this idea. Now, a big difference between children and teenagers is this. When a child looks at reality and sees it contradicts some principle you've taught him, he sticks to the principle and reinterprets what he's seeing and says he must be seeing it wrong. But a teenager, when he runs into a contradiction between what he sees and what you've taught him, he tends to change what he believes about what you taught him and believe what he's observing. And so when he starts to see the fact that the kids around him are doing a whole lot better and they don't give a rip about God, he starts to come back here and say, now, wait a minute. Maybe what Mom and Dad has taught me and what the church has taught me has to be looked at. Maybe it's not correct. Now, third of all, he notices some new things, he notices about how things could be changed. He begins to develop a new capacity to be creative and idealistic. To be creative. This is kind of a problem-solving ability now. And, you know, research has shown that the junior high kids are about the most creative at problem-solving than at any age. The thing they say that ruins creativity is the longer you stay in education. They took a group of graduate students and put them through the same test as a group of junior hires, and they found the junior hires were more creative, and the graduate students were just plain dumb in the way they did it. They took two pieces of string, and they hung them from the ceiling, and they could just barely reach each other where you could tie them together. But the problem is you couldn't go over and get this one and hang on to it and then go over and get this one. So somehow you had to figure out how to get these two strings together, and you're only given a pair of scissors, a mouse trap, and one other object. And the graduate students sat down with very elaborate charts trying to figure out how in the world they could catch a mouse without killing him, tie him to the string, and so he'd walk over and he'd be able to pick him up and tie the two strings together. Junior high kids took the scissors, tied them on the string, swung it, went over here and took this string and caught it and tied them together. Kids have an ability to be creative, and in some way those capacities have been impaired for us, and it's hard for us to understand how they can be so creative and come up with suggestions. Fourth, there's a new way in which they notice how things really are, especially beneath the surface. And with that is a new capacity to be sensitive, to be sensitive. Now teenagers begin to pick up what you're really thinking and not saying. And oftentimes they're wrong, but an awful lot of times they're right. They can now imagine what the people are saying about them as they walk down the hallway. And just tons of things begin to occur to them as they have this new capacity to be sensitive. There's also a way in which they observe now in a new way how things will turn out. They can begin to visualize consequences like they never could before. And with that, they have a whole new capacity to worry, to be terrified, to be afraid of things, because now they can visualize consequences that before they could not even hardly visualize. Now, starting their second week of their senior year, they can begin to visualize what it's going to be like to graduate and have nowhere to go. And that especially gets strong during second semester of their senior year. But there's a new capacity now to worry about things that they didn't have before as children. And finally, we see that there's a new way they observe how things can be avoided or hidden. And with that, a new capacity to be deceptive. That's bad news. But our teenagers begin to be, because of these formal thinking operations, now they begin to become aware how private thoughts really are. And they begin to realize that they don't have to be an open book to Mom and Dad. There's a whole lot they can think and feel and never have to show you, and realize that maybe it's a whole lot safer that way. And they also learn how to be good actors and actresses during this time, much more than children. Much more than children. How's a kid's world changing? Well, it changes in two ways. It really changes in what it expects from him, but also changes a whole lot in what he notices about his world. And so the world becomes a much more dangerous place, much more stress and pressure filled. What's the impact this new world then has on our kids? Well, you see two columns in your notes under point three there. And the left column should be labeled crises. And the right column should be labeled tasks. In this new world that kids have to face because their bodies are changing, their minds are changing, first of all, triggers three crises for the adolescents. It triggers three crises. And as well, it engages the adolescent in three tasks. Three crises that result in three jobs he has to complete, or three tasks. Now, what are these three crises? Well, let's just look at them very quickly. First of all, because he's in a new world and he observes this world in a different way, now there's a threat to stability. It threatens his stability as a person. It used to be that he had some certainty that he could control his world. But now, as he enters adolescence, he's got a new sense of being out of control. I can't control what my body's doing. You know, we wonder why some 7th and 8th grade kids aren't thinking more about the Lord, when one of the biggest problems 7th grade guys have is how to get through the school without an erection. Because that's a developmental thing. 7th and 8th grade guys, as their primary and secondary sexual characteristics are developing, there's also often unwanted erections. And we're wondering why kids aren't thinking more about witnessing when they're thinking about how they're going to get from this period to the next period without anybody seeing the fact they have erection and laughing at them. So there's a threat to stability. They're not even sure they can control their own body, let alone control the world that's often hostile. Mom and dad used to be able to bail them out. Mom and dad used to kiss it and make it feel better. Mom and dad used to be able to come over and fix things at school even. But now, mom and dad can't fix too many things for me. And there's not too much control of my world. My world can treat me and abuse me bad, and mom and dad can't do much about it, and I can't control my own body. One of the biggest times of trauma for kids is that 30-second period of time where he picks up his cafeteria tray off the table and takes it to the conveyor belt, praying that he doesn't drop it. Because if he does, it's emotional suicide in the school. Or to trip, or to drop your books. You know, and again, their bodies are changing. It's so easy to trip and do those kinds of things. Lack of coordination during this period of time. There's also a threat to his esteem. A new threat to his esteem as a person. You know, we said this thing that kids are now expected to kind of be fuelers instead of drainers. And the first few times they try to be a fueler, they tend to fail because they're kind of still too immature. They kind of fail in their first few relationships. They fail the first few times they try to be a man, they try to be a woman. And it's very easy for kids to come to this conclusion. I really don't have what it takes to be an adult man or woman. I really don't have what it takes, and I've got to figure out some way, because I'm kind of a nerd, and because I really don't have what it takes to be a real man or woman, I've got to figure out how to avoid anybody finding that out. And the world offers a lot of threats to his esteem, because he still feels awkward in the role of an adult, and yet he's awkward in the role of a child, and often ridiculed by his friends if he looks too childish, or if he looks like he's still hanging on to mom and dad too much. So we got an adolescent now who feels awkward in both roles, at both ends. And it's also a time where it threatens his security, especially in relationships. This is a time in which his body's changing, his mind is changing, and mom and dad are trying to make up their mind. Do we like this adult kid? We still love him, but do we like him? And the kids pick this up, and they start to feel like, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to count on mom and dad being there. But his friends are just as fickle, if not more so. He can commit social suicide so easily by just doing the wrong thing, or saying the wrong thing, or wearing the wrong thing. And so there's this sense of feeling insecure about relationships at home and relationships outside. So there's these crises going on as a result of the changes in his world, and it leaves him with three big jobs, three tasks to complete. And those tasks are listed there for you in your notes. First of all, to find stability in the midst of an unpredictable and often hostile environment. How in the world am I going to find stability in this world I can't control? Kids have to figure that out. That's their job during adolescence. Second of all, they have to figure out, how am I going to find a way to be esteemed, to feel important, in the midst of my own limitations and failures that are constantly being thrown back at me by my world? I'm constantly being reminded by mom and dad, by people at school, by my gym coach. I'm constantly being reminded how I don't stack up, how I don't have enough. And I've got to figure out somehow, in the midst of this world that's yelling at me, you're not enough, to feel good about myself. How am I going to figure that out? That's a job the kids have during adolescence, to figure out a way of life that finds the kind of esteem they need as an individual. And finally, his job is to find love while in relationships with selfish people. Kids begin to realize, because they look at mom and dad with mature eyes now, mature thinking, they begin to realize that mom and dad's love is not unconditional. It fails sometimes. Mom and dad can even be selfish at times. In fact, there's no one around that's not selfish, and how in the world am I going to find a way to find the love I need while in the midst of all these selfish relationships? Now, Christianity, I believe, is the only approach to life that offers answers to this, that offers a way of life to be able to meet these kinds of needs. Now, how is a parent to respond? How does parents fit into this whole thing with disappointment? And that's inevitable. It's inevitable that your child during this period of time, during adolescence, is going to be disappointed with you and blame you somewhat for their world being harsh and cruel. Where you used to be able to control the world and keep it from being very painful, now as they move into an adult world, you can't do that. And they're going to be kind of mad at you. I remember as I moved into adolescence and had a terrible case of acne and skin disease, that I blamed my mom for it. Somehow it was her fault because it was a genetic thing. And it's inevitable that kids are going to blame you for things that maybe don't have anything to do with what you did. But they're going to view you with disappointment because somehow they came to believe as kids that you had a power to keep them from experiencing pain. And that power now is running short. It's just not as omnipotent as it used to be. And they're going to feel disappointed about that. They're also going to feel disappointed because some of the things they always thought were true because you taught them, now they're starting to experience that out in the world they're not always true. And mom and dad, why did you ever teach me to believe this? So disappointment is inevitable. And it's something that we as parents need to develop a strategy. How are we going to respond to kids that are disappointed in us? We'll be having a lecture on that, talking about that in the weeks to come. But second of all, kids view their parents with a unique perspective. And this is the perspective. As I struggle to accomplish these tasks, what kind of response can I expect from my parents? Kids look through the eyeglasses of these crises and tasks at you to see how you line up. Will you be my rescuer? Will you be my adversary? Or will you be my ally? As I struggle to accomplish these tasks, try to find how in the world I can find equilibrium in this world that's coming apart, how everything's changing around me, including my own body, as they look to you, will they start to see you in the role of a rescuer, saying, well, yeah, I'll protect you, I'll try to protect you, and I'll keep you from having experiencing these crises. And if we struggle to try to fill that role, we're going to be making a mistake because we generate an unhealthy dependence in our kids, and it's going to result later in our kids even being more disappointed as they find out we really can't rescue them from all the trials of life. Or oftentimes parents unknowingly fall into the role of being an adversary during the period of adolescence. And the kids see the parents as not helping them with the task, but in a way getting in a way, blocking them. And oftentimes parents fall into this when they try to protect what damages a kid might cause their own personal selves and personal reputations during this period of time, and the kids begin to interpret their parents as adversaries and not allies. But there is a way to respond to our kids during this period of time where they begin to see us, not always, but to a large degree, they begin to see us as allies during this period of crisis, allies in accomplishing these three tasks. And I want to suggest to you that's what our job is as parents, to be allies with our kids during these times and help them accomplish these three tasks in a way that will result in some biblical formulas for living, in a way that their hearts as they emerge from our homes are somehow resemble the kind of heart purposes God wants them to have. And it really is possible to be allies during this period of time. How our kids view us during this period of adolescence, as adversaries or rescuers or allies, to a large degree depends on us and how we respond. That's where we're heading in the course. That's the challenge, to figure out how to provide the kind of environment which allies itself with kids and provides refuge. Now let's pray together, because this takes so much wisdom as we continue to work on this over the next several weeks. Let's pray. Father, thank you for just the assurance that we really can have homes that increase the probability that our kids will work out these tasks in a way where they'll be godly individuals, they'll choose godly lifestyles. To understand what's going on deep inside of our kids as they look at us and as they look at their worlds, it's not an easy thing, Lord, and we need lots of understanding and wisdom. And believe that it's only your lamp, your Spirit, and your Word that can give us that light. And we ask for those two partners as we move through this series and we struggle for insight and wisdom. What a difficult task, Lord, and we just lean on you, thanking you for this, the opportunity to move toward our kids and struggle to be the effective kind of parents that ally them during this period of time. And we pray this, Father, in Christ's name. Amen.